Welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm a speech and language pathologist located in San Jose, California, and I like to talk about all things medical speech and language related. We are working on a series with the podcast right now called How I Practice, and I'm interviewing speech and language pathologists all over the country and the world, actually, to talk about areas of interest within our practice. So today I'm joined with Erin Butler. Erin, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on and joining me. I'm really looking forward to our topic today. You picked mealtime modifications for individuals with dementia. I'm just going to dive in and ask a question. What makes you want to talk about this on a podcast?
So a passion of mine for a long time has been dementia, and I've worked with individuals primarily in skilled nursing and long-term care facilities. And it just seems like therapists at times we can get so stuck in the, and I guess I shouldn't say so stuck because it's what we do, but the, you know, exercises and what's the most appropriate diet and how to keep your patients safe, when with individuals such as those with dementia, there is a huge picture to look at. And that is, you know, with anything cognitive, communication, and swallow related. I've kind of over the years taken mental notes or, you know, taken CEUs, read a lot of articles on dementia and dysphagia, and thought it would be helpful for others to put that all in one place and share that.
Excellent. Awesome. I'm really excited about diving in more and really unpacking this topic with you. But before we go any further, tell me a little bit about you, Erin. Where are you? What do you do? How do you do it? Tell me all the things.
So I graduated from grad school in 2012. So became a speech language pathologist initially in the nursing homes. I didn't think that would stick forever. And it didn't, but it stuck for a very long time. I have practiced in the nursing homes for 11 years and just in the last year transitioned to home health. So that's been quite a bit of a change for me. So I've been doing that for almost exactly a year, a little over a year now. So I don't see quite the same population as I was when I was working in the skilled nursing facilities and long-term care facilities. But I am in Ohio, Northwest Ohio. I still work for the same company I hired on with actually when I graduated. I just kind of transitioned to a different day-to-day practice. So I have a passion for individuals with dementia, be it, you know, like I said, the cognitive communication aspect, as well as the swallowing. I definitely have an interest in dysphagia in general, but those are definitely my two passions. So that's kind of how we got here today.
Awesome. So in your home health practice, what percentage of your caseload, and I'm sure this varies, you know, week to week, month to month, mm-hmm. What percentage do you feel like you are working with individuals with dementia?
Probably, I wouldn't say more than 25%, 20-25%.
And what was it when you were working in long-term care and skilled nursing?
Gosh, at least probably 50%, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And I love when you were explaining earlier about kind of how you came into this topic area and what it means to you. And that, like, when we're trained as speech and language pathologists, it is to do like therapy, like mm-hmm. rehabilitative. like to see an improvement, to see a change. And when we work with this population, it's a very different ballgame. It takes a very different set of skills, and therapy needs to look really, really differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to dive into this topic some more and see what you've learned through your research, through your practice, and how you've kind of integrated that to share with us today. So where would you like to start? Where are we starting with our topic today?
Okay. Well, I have a couple questions for you to get us started. So
this is very exciting. I'm on board.
Yeah. Think about if you were hosting a get together with some family or friends. So what are some of the must-haves for your party?
Well, food. And I know it's like, oh, that's a very leading question, you know, but like, yeah. I can't socialize with people without eating or feeding them.
Exactly. Exactly. So same thing. If you think about meeting a friend somewhere to catch up, you're probably going to be at a coffee shop or, you know, a restaurant of some sort or what have you, or meet up for a drink or two. So I, like you, probably can't really imagine what it would be like to be in a situation like that and maybe have difficulty feeding myself, or maybe have challenges even with the visual perception of what I'm seeing, because we know food and drinks can be very beautiful. Someone setting a cup in front of me and not knowing what to do with it, because those are all things in reality that happen with individuals with dementia. And then you throw in the conversation aspect, you know, you're catching up, you're asking how life is, telling stories. And that's another area that these individuals can definitely struggle with. So, mm-hmm. you know, we think about eating and drinking, bringing pleasure to most of us. But when you think about pairing that with someone with dementia who has communication and cognitive changes, maybe changes with their sensation, their appetite, and then their ability to eat and drink, you know, it definitely is going to look and feel much different than it would for the typical individual.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do to account for that? Like you've already mentioned, like there's visual changes that happen in the progression of dementia. And so like, I know I've heard about really keying in on contrast. So using a like red or blue colored plate, because if you're serving like mashed potatoes on a white plate, like right. people can't Absolutely. See that. They won't be able to distinguish yep. what's on the plate.
So I've got lots of suggestions. The first thing I was going to just kind of review was some statistics, just so you know, we're all on the same page. And this was from 2021, so a couple years ago, but 50% of the individuals, if we're talking skilled nursing facilities, 50% of them have dementia. And of those individuals, 45 to 57% have dysphagia. So you're talking a decent amount here going to have both of those situations going on. Nearly half of those with dementia require some level of assistance at meals, which can result in diminished safety and nutrition if the caregivers are not trained. So we're going to talk a lot about the caregiver today, as well as some of those environmental modifications. And I love this quote, mealtime is a dance between partners. One partner's actions influence the others. And that's from a study that I'll have linked with the notes and everything. It's Amela 2002. And you think about, you know, if you're dancing with somebody, you have to be in sync, right? It takes two people, you know, to tango, I guess is what they say. And in late stage dementia, the amount of food that is consumed is influenced by the quality of that exchange between nursing home residents and their caregivers. So they did this study, which I'll briefly discuss. There were 53 caregivers and 53 residents with later stage dementia. They did a number of different assessments, the mini mental status exam, the global deterioration scale. They averaged out how many years they were in the nursing home. 59% of these individuals were on a pureed diet, and they averaged a 6.1 GDS. And then they used some different instruments to analyze where they were at with their swallowing. So I don't know if you or any of the listeners have used the Enenberg Feeding Evaluation in Dementia, but it is excellent, the EdFedQ. They used that. They used interaction behavior measure, and then the modified, where they measured both the resident and the CNA's behavior. So,
wow.
Yes, it was really an eye-opener here. It was almost split. 23 of these individuals were considered resistors, meaning they had some sort of resistance during the meal, and then 30 of them were acceptors. So the meal proportion consumed varied. The amount of food that was offered on the individual's trays varied by day. The mean length of time for the resistors was 18 minutes, where the acceptors was only 18 minutes, and then the acceptors was only 13.8 minutes. For that resistor group, they presented with more oral residue and more dysfunctional CNA behavior and resident behavior versus those who were acceptors. So I did want to mention, I have so much respect for the nursing home aides. I think they have an extremely difficult job. They're with these very special populations all day, and I know they don't get paid enough, and probably don't get recognized enough either for what they do. But just for the topic of this conversation, we are unfortunately going to talk about some of those aspects that influence the not so good intake at meals. The residents were misinterpreted. So they were labeled as being uncooperative or lazy when they were attempting to refuse to eat or drink, or perhaps maybe they were holding their food in their mouth or their drink and not swallowing as quickly. But when they looked at the study, they showed that these individuals' positioning was less than ideal. They were not necessarily given the most appropriate texture, and they were provided with too large of bites and were fed too quickly. The study noted that there were, to no surprise, insufficient staff numbers. We know that that's an issue all of the time, and training as well. And that they were often stopped during the meal when they were maybe refusing, like turning their head or blocking the aide from feeding them. Or if they spit their food out, then the aide was like, okay, we're done. Interruptions was another factor here. And then the CNAs not necessarily responding appropriately to the patient's cues. The CNAs had left to feed others, which again, with being short staffed, that obviously happens. The trays were removed. And then there also were errors when reporting how much food was consumed. And so it was overestimated by 15 to 20%. So, you know, you might be doing some chart reviews and see that, oh, they're eating, you know, 75 to 85% of their meals and they're still losing weight. But given this study, you know, that maybe isn't always 100% accurate. The CNA's bothered and inflexible behaviors may have created an environment of excess stress resulting in dysfunctional behaviors, such as those determined during the EdFedQ and the IBMM. The considerations for refusal versus disease process was something I wanted to talk about too. So looking at those refusals, is it actually them refusing and because they don't want to eat because they don't want to live anymore? Or could it be just a behavior associated with this disease process? And could it be modified or mitigated by the actions of the caregiver themselves? So, you know, and depending on which setting you're talking, you know, now that I'm in home health, I can see some of the trainings that I can do with caregivers in the home, be it, you know, an aide, or most of the time it's a family member. So this can go, you know, both ways, not necessarily just CNAs, but that was what the study was on.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll jump in then to some of the modifications that can be made during mealtime, the first being the caregiver themselves and what we can do to enhance the quality of mealtime with those with dementia. So sitting at the same height and within view of the individual. So this, you know, seems kind of obvious, but I've seen a lot where it's like, okay, let me give so-and-so a couple bites real quick and I'm standing over them, feeding them. But you can think of how intimidating that might be or scary for somebody. So really, truly sitting with them and within view. So, you know, sometimes too, if you're sitting next to the individual and not, you know, angling yourself, they might literally just see a hand come around with a spoon because their peripheral vision isn't the best, because that's an issue that we know of as well. Mm-hmm. Attending to the individual by addressing them and sharing that experience to validate that social importance of the meal is definitely crucial. And then with the communication challenges, we definitely want to reduce our rate of speed for improved processing, use more of that concrete language and simple structure. And research tells us that 5 to 9 words in length are optimal to assist in improving short-term memory and processing. So just something else to think about when we're talking. I don't know about you, but as a speech therapist, it's just like so easy to talk. And sometimes I have to reel it in and it's like, okay, they're not processing all of this information.
Yeah. Yeah.
Avoid negative comments about the food. So this is unfortunately something that happens often to, you know, an individual, be it a family member or an aide or nurse, you know, might say, oh gosh, I wouldn't eat that if I were you either. You know, so that negative connotation can definitely play a role there.
Mm-hmm.
Avoiding elder speak. So, you know, we're all adults just talking to one another in that fashion. And then providing some cues. So obviously verbal cues are important. Notifying them when you're going to give them a bite, if they're someone who needs that assistance with feeding, or Mary, I've got a drink for you. Here's your lemonade, versus just over and over handing it to them or giving it to them. You can implement visual aids such as imitation and mirroring. And tactile cues, careful hand feeding, pacing, and normal bite sizes, as well as hand-over-hand feeding. I loved the podcast where you had Tipa Snow on back in 2019. Excellent, mm-hmm. Excellent podcast. I could listen to her for hours.
I know. Yeah.
She discussed though hand under hand feeding. And actually prior to listening to that, I hadn't heard of that. So that was really insightful. But what that is guided assistance in the palm of the hand, which decreases that impulse to pull away, such as someone might have when you're doing a hand over hand. So that hand under hand encourages self-feeding or other action patterns by triggering muscle memory. So just another type of cue that could be beneficial during meals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of always establishing the context and acknowledging that even though we may have been sitting there for like 10, 15 minutes, that doesn't mean that the person with dementia is, their mind hasn't wandered or they're reminiscing about something decades ago. Right. And so I really like that you mentioned, you know, using those verbal cues, using their name. People respond to their name like almost immediately. Like if you just talk, but then you say their name, like, you know, you'll see a head turn and the eyes meet you. Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, yeah. I really love that in establishing what it is. You know, you said, okay, not verbatim, but you were like, Mary, I have your drink. Here's your lemonade. So it wasn't just like, hey, drink something or here's your drink. You use the name, you said what it is, and then specifically what it is. So there could be processing and have an anticipation of what it's going to taste like. And maybe if you just said, here's your drink, and they were thinking it was going to be water, and then they taste lemonade and they're like, okay, that's not what I was expecting. Right?
Yes. It's all about that big picture. And, you know, all of there, we're going to discuss a lot of things today. And obviously, you don't want to go into your treatment tomorrow and try to implement all of these things. But, you know, picking and choosing for that individual that you're working with, because everyone is so individualized in all of our, we know that every treatment doesn't look the same, or no treatment doesn't look the same. It's important to, I think when I started thinking about stepping back from the patient and even, I hate to use the word observing because, you know, we don't, observing per se isn't skilled, right? But it is in certain aspects such as those with dementia, because you might sit for 10 minutes during a meal at your evaluation to see how the caregiver's interacting with the patient. What are some barriers there that you can use your skill then to teach the others of how to modify? And maybe one of those things that we talked about would be a game changer for a whole meal, not necessarily mm-hmm. everything, but.
Right. Yeah. I really do think observation is skilled, because it depends on what you do with that observation and how it informs your treatment plan mm-hmm. and the results thereafter. So it's like, if you just sit and look, that's one thing, but it's like, what are you doing with that observation? Like you just described, you know, you're creating a plan, you know, you're learning about the individual and what's working for them, what's not working for them, and how you can translate that to improvements and gains and trainings for the people around them.
Absolutely. Okay. So we talked about the caregiver. Next up is environmental modifications to promote improved mealtime. So it's important to all of us in our ability to have a say in who we sit with or where we sit at a meal. You know, you sit down next to your best friend to catch up for during supper versus maybe someone that you don't know as well at a big gathering. That's no different for these individuals. They often will have an opinion about what they want, but may have the challenges in verbalizing that. So some environmental modifications that we as clinicians may implement and train the caregivers on, one of those would be being out of bed for meals. So again, this seems like an obvious recommendation, right? But unfortunately, in the long-term care setting or skilled nursing setting, this isn't as easy or doesn't happen as often. But being out of bed for a meal is not only going to decrease that risk of aspiration, but can improve the alertness and then give that social component that mealtime typically has versus sitting in your room by yourself eating versus a dining room with other individuals. Adequate lighting is super important. Older individuals require 3 times the amount of light than those who are younger. We want to ensure the optimal lighting is used to facilitate improved ability to see during meals. And then again, something obvious but happens all the time. Glasses, not having glasses on during meals can be just something so small, but make a huge difference. And this brings me to your question from earlier, the place setting. So that contrast for those people who maybe have the visual perceptual challenges, we want to minimize clutter and avoid patterns. You know, think of those busy placemats or busy chinaware, you know, or dishes, something that's more neutral, you know, maybe if, like you were saying, the white plate with mashed potatoes on top, an individual might not even be able to recognize that they have anything on their plate, where maybe a red plate with the mashed potatoes on top. Okay, now I can truly see the difference. Limiting the number of utensils, food, and drink items at a time will help improve the attention. If you think about the tray getting delivered at a mealtime and all the stuff, for lack of better words, on that tray, there's so much. You've got the salt and pepper packets and the sugar packets and maybe the creamer, and then their silverware is wrapped up in their napkin, so they might not even know it's there. And they might have, who knows, like 3 to 4 drinks. And then their plate of food that maybe has, I mean, usually at least 2, sometimes 3 items, and then probably some sort of dessert in a bowl. That's a lot. And oftentimes, like, I think, gosh, I wouldn't even be able to eat all of this food, you know, let alone someone who may have dementia and their appetite isn't quite the same. So what I'll do is training with the individuals who are setting the patients up and explain, you know, perhaps you put the plate of food down in front of them with a drink and then help them get their utensils out and put the utensil maybe even in their hand and get them started. If they need help with the condiments, helping with that, and then getting rid of those wrappers. Like, you don't need those distracting them at all. So just kind of looking over that setting and figuring out what will be the most optimal for them is definitely crucial. Seating arrangements is another consideration that's very important. So like we discussed, you're not going to sit with someone maybe who you don't really know that well, or maybe who you dislike. You might consider placing a level of varying dementia individuals together. And so one may be higher level and one may be a little bit lower level. And the higher level individual may be able to help the other. So there is a study that I included that discusses the correlation between nursing staff also being present during meals with an increased dependence. And when no nursing was present, then those helpers were more apt to help one another. So something to consider. And then, of course, your feeding assistant groups. You can have those, you know, special dining as needed to improve the fluid and food intake. You're also going to want to pay attention to noises and sounds and allow for some familiar sounds to be present at mealtime. Oftentimes, I've noticed maybe televisions are very loud or maybe not even really like appropriate for that setting. So maybe turning that off or picking some soft, age-appropriate and culturally appropriate music, as the music can help with reducing agitation during meals. And it can have positive effects on feeding and intake for those with those in the dementia population. And then avoiding interruptions. This is going to be very important, and it's something that I've often observed, and I don't think it's ever intentional, but scheduled medications, blood draws, finger sticks, etc. Doing those prior to or after a meal when possible. I have seen firsthand nursing come in at the middle of a meal and give the patient their medications, and what do you know? They don't want to eat anymore. So definitely educating your staff on completing those ahead of time or after when possible. I know things happen. And next, we're going to move to cognitive interventions for mealtime. So us as clinicians, we should capitalize on the patient's strengths and help to maintain them as long as possible. So these might include implementing like a spaced retrieval training, which capitalizes on non-declarative and procedural memory, as well as stimulus-based training, which are less impacted in those with dementia than, say, like a declarative or a working memory. We want to use teaching of those swallowing strategies and recommendations we can use during spaced retrieval training, and the increased exposure and retention provided during the meaningful and related relatable information with that repetitive practice is definitely crucial. So, you know, maybe the individual with dementia can still consume thin liquids if they take small sips. You know, you might practice, what do you have to remember when you take your drink? And then give that prompt, take a small sip, just to help improve that safety and maintain their ability to continue to drink regular liquids as well as safe as possible. Implementing visual memory aids. So say the spaced retrieval training isn't wonderful, isn't going well, or you want to supplement that. Visual memory aids in this population can definitely be beneficial, as the ability to read is often preserved into the later stages of dementia. So these might include those safe swallowing strategies, or, you know, maybe what foods are or are not on their recommended food list if there are certain items to avoid. Jennifer Brush in 2018, she gave some excellent suggestions and facts on the preferred presentation of visual aids for the aging and dementia populations. And this included large print with simple words and high contrast, the sans serif typeface, so the like Arial, Tomaha, etc., with the colors blue, red, and then green. Those were the preferred colors in this population. And using, this was new to me, using a colored background with white writing is actually preferred and easier to read for these individuals. Avoiding all capital letters, and then incorporating signage of light color for specific areas of your building. So maybe your dining room signs are blue and your activity signs are red, and so on. So that way they have some association there. I've also had luck laminating or even using like those cheap plastic picture frames. You can get them like Dollar Tree or Dollar General, to make it look nice and presentable versus just this piece of paper sitting on the dining room table or in a room that gets spilled on and is dirty. So that's something just to kind of dress it up and keep it nice for longer. Additionally, later stages in dementia may require increased cues beyond those visual cues or aids. And I know I've actually experienced this. I don't know about any of you, but individuals saying, how can I pay for my meal? Or what do I owe you? And I've seen, you know, the, oh, no, no, you don't have to pay. You know, you live here and this is already paid for. You can just kind of engage in that with them and take maybe their meal ticket as a receipt, essentially. And they won't, you know, they often won't know any different, and they will feel like they contributed and paid for their meal. Alertness at mealtime is something to definitely pay attention to. If the patient's eyes are closed and they can still follow one-step commands or answer questions, then their alertness may be sufficient for safe and effective intake. When alert, we do want to provide the foods and liquids to maintain nutrition if deemed safe. So, you know, I know I've had patients on my caseload in the past who infrequently open their eyes, but will always answer questions. So definitely want to take those times of alertness and optimize the intake during those times. Next up, I wanted to talk about some adaptive equipment. So we want to become best friends, if you're not already, with your OT. No offense to PTs, because we love them as well. But with our OTs, you know, we really can promote that increased independence, again, the nutrition and hydration and safety with meals. They've got a different skill set than we do, and we have a different skill set as they. So kind of combining that together to figure out and tackle these challenges at meals are definitely imperative. Serving food in a bowl instead of a plate may be helpful. It would allow for, you know, more scooping. They also make plates with rims or edges. You might implement or ask OT to implement a large handled utensil, maybe using a spoon instead of a fork to scoop. Or maybe they're at the point where they just do much better with finger foods and using utensils isn't really working well anymore. Also using some easy to grasp cups and glasses. I've seen the cups with a suction on the bottom, cups with lids. I've also noticed using clear cups are helpful. Versus those that are not, because maybe they don't even realize that they have a glass that's still half full. Maybe they think it's empty because they can't see it. So just that, again, that visual feedback paired with some small little modifications can go a long way. Next up, we're going to transition more towards the alternate in supplemental nutrition. So we may opt to collaborate or refer to dietary when appropriate to improve the patient's nutrition outside of meals. And these might include but are not limited to, like, say, hydration cart. I know we implemented this at some of our nursing homes where like therapy had their own hydration station, we called it. And the therapists were encouraged to give their patients drinks before, during, after. And they had a big container of water that they kept. I think sometimes they maybe put fruit in it as well. We also had on each shift an aide of some sort come around and pass out drinks. Implementing happy hour, so working with activities and seeing, do you have a scheduled happy hour? Could that be something fun that you could implement at your facility just to promote that increased intake? I also just kind of had a sit down conversation with one of our activities departments too. Kind of like with therapy, maybe the activity doesn't revolve around eating or drinking, but it's so simple just to have available, you know, a few drinks from the kitchen where you can pass them out beforehand and they can sip on it while they're playing bingo. You know, perfect way to just get some hydration in during an activity. Also providing snacks throughout the day and then handheld snacks for those who are more of the wanderers. Oftentimes, our facilities will have bins at the nurses' stations with just some easy grab-and-go snacks, you know, different bars, things like that, that, oh, Helen's passing by. Let me get her, you know, a granola bar because it's 10 o'clock and she ate at 8, but didn't eat a whole lot. So just a quick way while she's taken a walk or a stroll around the building to get in some nutrition. And appetite stimulants and nutrition supplements may be another avenue if needed, but of course, talk with your dietitian about that. And lastly, wanted to talk about those individuals who are more end of stage dementia, end of life, and what types of considerations we might have and what our role looks like there. So like you said, Leanne, at the beginning, you know, most of us, and I think during our trainings, we've got that rehabilitative mindset where we're going to do exercises and we're going to try to help fix this problem or rehabilitate it, where this may just be more of that habilitative kind of what can I do to just supplement where they are now and help them with being as successful as they can be for as long as they can be versus necessarily fixing a problem. It's definitely, you know, going to look different for our palliative and hospice stage patients, where that primary focus is going to be more on support, caregiver training, and working with your interdisciplinary team to help put those pieces together to help with life, nutrition, and hydration. We need to become familiar with our role in this stage so that we don't let our personal discomfort impact our patient's care. Helping the families and loved ones understand the end stages of the disease is so important when families are, you know, concerned that perhaps their loved one is suffering or they're being starved because they cannot eat. You know, I specifically remember a conversation I had with a daughter of a patient of mine. She felt like you guys are just going to let mom die. She's not eating. So obviously, you know, that conversation had to happen with the other interdisciplinary team members that, you know, in all actuality, withdrawing nutrition at the end stages of life can in fact improve comfort. You know, if someone's not wanting to eat, maybe feeding tubes aren't actually appropriate in not recommended in the older adults with advanced dementia, and that they're actually associated with agitation and greater use of physical and chemical restraints and greater healthcare use due to the tube feeding related complications, as well as pressure ulcers. So having those conversations absolutely are not easy. But if we're educated and feel more confident in having those conversations, it definitely will help those loved ones be more at ease and then perhaps help make the individual with dementia be more comfortable in their last, you know, months or weeks or days. So just to kind of wrap things up, obviously, you know, I know we didn't talk about much about the assessments or specific treatment approaches, but these modifications essentially are your treatment approaches with these individuals. And by being knowledgeable, we as speech language pathologists play a very large role in educating caregivers and even those interdisciplinary team members that we work with to promote the highest level of independence and safety and nutrition and hydration, and arguably the most important being their quality of life at, you know, all stages of the illness, but especially towards the end stages.
Okay, so here's what I'm thinking. I'm still a little bit obsessed about what we touched on earlier in the chat about observation and how, you know, we really put the word out there about how we really shouldn't like document observed or observation for diet toleration. Mm-hmm. There's you know, I don't want to get into that part, but here's the bone I want to pick is that I feel like our observation is skilled and highly necessary and full of data collection. I mean, because in what you just shared with us, like we need to be observing and collecting data on, are these strategies working? What needs to be modified to improve whatever isn't working? Is there more training that's necessary? Do we need to alter the environment? Do like, there's so many things that we won't know if we don't take the time to observe it without interfering with it. So sometimes I feel like there's a war in my own head about like, okay, how much observation is too much? But then I'm like, this is data collection. And as long as I'm able to demonstrate that in my skilled documentation about this skilled observation and how it's influencing the plan of care and influencing the activities related with the patient, then I think that's really important. What are your thoughts? Since you have like worked in this setting, worked in this population, what do you think?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And the reason I mention the observation, and I use air quotes, is I know I have some experience too with working in with corporate and doing some like Medicare Part B denials. So I've taken part of some of that back end work with like the judges and the representatives from Medicare and, you know, what do they see as skilled? So we actually, our company has some documentation tips and I know for a fact that observe is one of those words on there. And it's easy to just, okay, we're not going to use that. But, you know, if you think of it as a clinician, okay, well, if I'm observing, I'm doing something bad. You know, I think it is just a matter of maybe getting unique in how you are documenting what it is that you're doing and how what you're doing is something that maybe a caregiver or a CNA or a nurse couldn't do. In regards to the skilled component and reimbursement. But I 100% agree with you that sitting and paying attention to that individual in that environment. So where we talked about stepping back, stepping away, it's so easy just to like grind throughout your day and work with these people. But sometimes I've caught myself thinking, okay, like let's stop all that and let's just like step back and look around this room, look around the dining room or at this table and watch the individual just do their day-to-day tasks, you know, and you will pick up on so much that you're using your skills to now make minor changes that make a significant difference in the long run to, you know, whatever it might be. It might not even be swallowing related because there's so much with this population that we can do. But that's why I said like OTs, I don't think it's coincidental that I'm the number of different nursing homes I've worked in or we've had some changeover with OTs. Like I am really good friends with the occupational therapists that I've worked with and we get together outside of work and still stay in touch. Because our, you know, our minds kind of think alike. And we do cross over in a lot of what we do. So, you know, if you get patients with feeding challenges, just consulting with your OT, hey, this is what's happening. What kind of recommendations do you have? Or, you know, just kind of putting your minds together goes a long way. And you might notice and implement some things from them that you wouldn't have thought of too. So I highly recommend that if you guys aren't doing that already.
Yeah, I agree. I love all those suggestions. And like to your point, I don't think I've ever documented observation in any of my notes. You know, that's never been how I've recorded anything, even though I have completed observation tasks that have influenced, you know, the course of therapy and their outcomes. So it's, you know, I just frame it as like patient demonstrated XYZ. And how did I know that? Because I saw it, people.
Right. What are we doing? We're observing them. We're watching them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important. I like how you touched on, like, we're so like going. And that's really important that, like, when I was in grad school, the part of the class we took on like language disorders, for example, was broken into two parts, assessment and intervention. So therapy was called intervention. And what is intervention? Where we go in and we interrupt something, right? And so I feel like that's kind of the mindset that we get, that unless we're literally interfering with something, putting our hand in the mix, saying something, doing something, then we're not doing therapy. And I don't know why I'm just so obsessed with this, like this observation, like hang up, where it's like, I'm not advocating that we just sit around and, you know, right, quote, observe all day.
Right.
But it's like, we really do need to like see what's happening without our intervention, without our interruptions to the day, like what's happening.
And there's definitely a difference between someone who, you know, has had a stroke and now you're sitting observing them during a meal, you know, that
is there
a place for that? You know, that's another story. Versus you've got an individual with dementia who's losing weight, they're spitting out their foods, they're getting irritated with, you know, their caregivers or who are trying to feed them. You know, there's lots of different things that we can look out for, where that, you know, that sit back and kind of look and see is very telling versus that may not be skilled for another individual, but for this population, I think it's 100% imperative.
Yeah. And it's like you are using that time to detective work because you're trying to assess what's causing this. If I make a change here or there, will that have a positive outcome that we are intending to have?
Right.
And the only way you're going to know that is if you spend some time seeing what their environment is like, what their eating schedule is like, what interruptions are present, how the caregiver interacts with them, where they're seated, like all the things that you mentioned earlier. We're not going to know that unless we take the time to observe it. Detective wise. I'm like, there has to be a skilled word for observe, because it is, it's a, like a dirty word. Like we cannot, you know, use it in our documentation. It's like a red flag.
And I feel like I often use the word analyze, like clinician analyzed patient during, you know, interaction with, you know, CNA or what have you, like that I'm analyzing them. It's just kind of a maybe a prettier word than observed. I don't know, because I am, you're analyzing, you're assessing, you know, it's just a little bit different terminology is all, really.
Yeah. I think that was a really good replacement, because where observe really only entails that you're just sitting and watching something. You're not doing anything with that information. But when you say analyze, it means you're collecting data and doing something with that data. So good swap. Thanks, Erin.
Yeah.
If I ever find myself in skilled nursing, I don't know what to do. All right. Well, I've really enjoyed this talk. Thank you so much for joining me here today and sharing all the things that you've learned. As I look through the notes that you've created, I mean, you've referenced so many different articles and like learning opportunities that you've experienced. Like this isn't just a one-stop shop that just happened like on a weekend. Like this is like over the course of years, you've come across this information, like put it together. It's informed your practice. And so thank you so much for sharing that with us today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm happy to.
Now, if there are people who want to reach out and get in touch with you and learn more, how might they go about doing that?
So you can reach out to me at, my email is probably the easiest way, erin.butler@ec-rehab.com. So if you have any questions or anything at all, feel free to reach out and I'd be happy to help. answer anything that I can. Awesome. Give any suggestions.
Yay. That's awesome. I feel like we always are looking for someone to bounce ideas off of, especially like if we're the only SLP, you know, working in a facility, or if we get an area that we're not as well versed in as other areas. And we just need kind of someone who's really spent some time deep diving to chat with. So,
yeah. And I think if just a kind of a thought that I had too, if, you know, you're treating an individual and you're thinking, you know, just something doesn't feel right, I don't feel like I'm making a difference, then maybe it is time to just like step back and look at that big picture. And I feel like just doing that has changed so much with the way that I practice.
Excellent. That's right. I love that. Like just hit pause, zoom out. Mm-hmm. And, then sometimes it comes together. Very nice.
Yes.
Okay. Is there any like little last nugget that you want to leave with our listeners?
I think I just said it. Just that looking at the individual, versus looking at maybe the diagnosis, you know, just studying them in their environment and how they are interacting with others around them. Your treatments may not be the 5 day a week for 45 minutes, you know, you may only have to do a couple few times a week for a week or two, you know. Although there are so many areas to look at, obviously, that's not a concrete number. Again, everyone's so individualized, but just keeping in mind that looking at the individual and what they need and just kind of personalizing it to them.
Excellent. I love that. I feel like that's like I want that on a t-shirt for SLPs. Like, look at the individual, not the diagnosis.
Like, that would be cool.
Yeah. A really important like way to practice. I love it.
I'll buy the t-shirt.
All right. Excellent. We'll be able to retire early. I love it. All right, Erin. Anything else that you want to cover? I think we did everything. You good?
I'm good. All set.
All right. Well, for our listeners, thank you for joining us for this conversation today. I hope that all of Erin's research and practice has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish as well, and that you go out there and be awesome. And thanks again, Erin, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.